Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, January the 15th, 2026. And I want to freak you out a little bit with time. Not only is it 2026, but the first half of the first month of 2026 is gone. 15, there's a 31 in, so maybe like midday today or something, but we're kind of already there. So half the first month of the new year is already gone. What have you been doing to build your independence, liberty, self-sufficiency, and self-reliance? Because, as I always say, life is not a static scale. You are moving in one direction or the other. There is no pause button in life. As life moves forward, even if you think you're staying put, you're actually moving backward. So either you're letting life push your liberty quotient in reverse, or you're actively engaging, increasing it as you move along with time forward. Those are your two choices. You do not have another one. Tick-tock. The clock ticks for us all. Got a good lineup for you today of expert council members. Leading off, Chris Rossini and Dr. Paul will talk about Trump telling the EU you can either have us deal with Greenland the easy way or the hard way. And they have, you know, what you would expect to be their viewpoint of it. And much of the sentiment I agree with. I'm just going to ask a question. How many people trying to analyze Donald Trump have never read, or at least not recently read, The Art of the Deal? Because did Trump just get what he wants without spending a dime? What does he really want? Because he wants rare earth elements. Yeah, we can lease, you know, we can go extract those with the lease agreement with Greenland. That's not a problem. What does he say he wants anyway? And did he just get it? Without actually having to do anything except talk. I'm going to tell you something, and I'll explain it when we start going through the segments. If you read Art of the Deal, Trump making a bunch of noise, spending no money, and then getting what he wants, it's a pattern that goes back at least to the 1970s, because that book wasn't even published. It was published so long ago. It was published in 1989. I first read it when I was in the military, probably around 92, as I was beginning to think about what I wanted to do when I got out from a business perspective, and it seemed like a good book to read. This will not be a defense of Orange Man, just an observation of reality, something a lot of people have been having trouble with in the past few weeks for some reason. Then we'll move on to some stuff that actually is more practical, homesteady, you know, lifestyle design type stuff. Joe Riles will talk about the weakness of a trainer training your dog for you, where you drop your dog off at dog school for 2 weeks and then go pick the dog up and basically go through with the instructor all the things the dog learned, and then you go home and then the dog stops doing all the things. It's not the dog's fault. It's not the trainer's fault. At least one person in the equation. We'll talk about that today. And it's kind of a metaphor for a lot of things in life. It's not really the government's fault. It's not the libtard's fault. It's not the conservative's fault. It's not even the illegal immigrant's fault. No matter what I think it should be done about all of those groups, it's not their fault that your life has a problem in it. The number one impact on how your life works out, you can go see it right now in a mirror. Mike Molito will talk about restoring older guns. I didn't listen to his segment yet. I just listened to the very beginning of it to make sure it worked. And he said, I think Jack will have some thoughts on this. I bet you I will, but I'm going to wait and hear what Mike has to say first before responding. Doc Bones will talk about treating eye infections when there's no doctor but you, because you can't get to medical assistance. This is one of those places where something that would be relatively minor right now, day to day, if you can seek medical assistance, could become severely dangerous and life-altering if you didn't have the knowledge of what to do and didn't have access to higher-level care, which can happen at times. Ryan Steva will talk about practical homestead automation with smart devices and still staying private, because some people don't want to use smart information because I don't know the people at Amazon will know the flow rate of your aquaponics system. Or I don't know, but apparently that is the case. And then John Pugliano will give you a lightning round to kick off 2026 investing, most of which I will agree with, not all. And then I will talk to you about the ICE protests yet again this week, because I'm a masochist and I want to run back into the teeth of my own audience. But I want to point something out to you. The ICE protests are a precision weaponization of useful idiots. Yeah, the people in the streets are morons. They really are. And at the end of today, you'll either understand that or you don't want to. I'm always open to being wrong, but at times I think like my right, like the odds that I'm right are more like 95% or better, and I would push that even a little higher on this because I'm a student of history and I read books. You know, and I'm good at pattern recognition. This is Saul Alinsky 101. Remember when I talked about rules of radicals for the right? And I said it is not the rules for radicals that are the problem, it is who is applying them and how they're being applied. So that doesn't mean that everybody that uses them is good. What it means is it's a handbook to weaponize activism, and it is being used with absolute precision here. Though I would tell you in a way that I don't think Alinsky would actually care for. Alinsky was very careful to stay at least within the spirit of the law. Alinsky was very careful to try to utilize things that people found untenable without actually creating an environment where the activists would be arrested. They were really good at it, like the famous Chicago airport shit-in. I didn't say sit-in, I said shit-in. That never happened because it was so off-putting to the people that they were organizing against that they caved before it ever happened. If you look at the history of the things that Alinsky was directly involved with, it never involved setting things on fire, knocking cars over, shoving police officers and things like that. He was far more sophisticated. But it doesn't mean that less sophisticated people can't pick up the manual and run with it, which the left has been doing since Alinsky was still out actively working. They were already bastardizing some of his concepts, but actually making them more effective when they do. What I'm saying is, what's being done by these people in the streets is incredibly effective, but not because of them. Because of the macro that's occurring, and that's why many of you are having a hard time accepting what I'm telling you about it. I ask only that you listen to what I have to say about it today, and then back up for 10 minutes, imagine that there's a possibility that you've misread it, run through the scenario, and then if you still feel the way that you feel, I'm not here to tell you how to feel. I'm just here to tell you how I feel. And if you can't deal with how I feel when my opinion has no impact on what's actually going to happen, then I'm going to invite you to go meet that person we talked about earlier with the dog problem. The guy in the mirror. Go talk to them because the problem lies in you, not in me. The fact that you disagree with me should not like cause you major trauma in your life. When you're done listening to my show, if you happen to disagree with one of my takes, you should be able to go on with your life and not worry about it anymore. If you feel compelled to write me emails threatening to not listen to me if I keep saying it, that's not my problem. That's not my problem. In fact, I've only ever told two types of people to sod off and not listen to me anymore. And the primary group, and I would say this is like 8 out of 9 out of 10, are people who say, if you do this, I won't, like, goodbye. Goodbye. Because I'm not a simp. I'm not here to keep you happy. And I don't think that most of you, even those of you angry with me right now, would want to be here if I acted that way. If I actually did what you demanded of me, you'd say I sold out, even to you, right? You don't want somebody that's going to change their opinion because you threatened them with a boycott when they don't give a fuck if you listen or not. Like, you don't want that, okay? What is the other group of people I've told not to listen? People that are so unhinged that they don't make any sense at all, and they're just shrieking and yelling and thrashing about, and you can tell that that person's IQ is somewhere in Somaliland level. Yeah, there's no point to that person. They're just a pain in the ass, and they need to go away. So, if you hear what I have to say today and you don't like it, and you can object with your, you know, rational, logical points, I'll listen to you. I probably won't agree with you, but I'll listen to you, and I'll respect you as a person, even if I don't respect your opinion. But if you threaten me, I don't give a fuck. Goodbye. And by the way, if you're an old-timer like one of these people recently was, that's what you've tuned in for 18 years. Someone that wouldn't tell you what you wanted to hear or wouldn't acquiesce because somebody else threatened them, somebody that would give you their honest opinion, whether you agreed with it or not. It just so happens that now it's really inconvenient for you that I don't agree with you. It's kind of messed up, really, when you think about it. That anybody would expect that someone that's done the work that I've done now for almost 2 decades would change what they say or stop speaking about something because one person or two people or even 100 people, F it, even 1,000 people threatened to not listen. It's okay. You don't have to listen. Nobody ever made you. That's how I feel about all this. And hopefully today when I explain what I have to explain, you'll understand why I hold the line on some of these things. It isn't that I trust government or I think Orange Man is great. Not at all. In fact, the number one reason I want people deported is because I do not trust my government. I do not trust my government at all. And that actually makes more the case that you don't want people from third world shitholes with major saves and major impacts on what happens in your country. If you truly trusted your government, if your government actually ran the country well, if the government actually ensured that they protected the rights of privacy and safety and property and security of the average person, I would be much more open to a more immigration-friendly world. But that's not what we have. It is precisely because I do not trust them that I do not want unfettered immigration into my country. And some people recently took issue with that. I'm soapboxing here, I'm sorry. But yeah, your country? Yes, my country. I live here, it's mine. It's also yours, but it's also mine. I own land here. I'm an evil landholder, right? Clearly a typical patriarchal white supremacist because I actually own land that I pay for and I take care of. And I shepherd and I steward. That makes me evil. Okay, fine. But that also makes me own a piece of it. It is mine. Just like it is yours, whether you want a piece of it or not. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and drop on in. Hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on Trump's message to the EU. And that will then have my follow-up and go, but did he get what he wanted and you just don't realize it?
The United States needs Greenland for the purpose of national security. It is vital for the Golden Dome that we are building. NATO should be leading the way for us to get it. If we don't, Russia or China will, and that's not going to happen. That's all caps, by the way. Militarily, without the power of the United States, much of which I built during my first term, and now I'm bringing to a new and even higher level, NATO would not be an effective force or deterrent, not even close. They know that, and so do I. NATO becomes far more formidable and effective with Greenland in the hands of the United States. Anything less than that is unacceptable. Thank you for your attention to the matter, President DJT.
To me, the most interesting part is why the rhetoric and why the demands and this effort to do this when we have... We have a few other problems to deal with, and Trump has enough foreign enemies. I mean, he doesn't win friends and influence people, but he loses. So I think, you know, somebody said, well, why don't we just have a referendum? This is a good idea. But there's been a lot of referendum up there, and the people there aren't exactly happy to say, oh, yeah, we want to be part of New York City.
Yeah.
How much money are you thinking of giving people in Greenland to get them on board with a possible U.S.
I'm not talking about money for Greenland yet. I might talk about that. But right now, we are going to do something on Greenland, whether they like it or not, because if we don't do it, Russia or China will take over Greenland. And we're not going to have Russia or China as a neighbor. I would like to make a deal, you know, the easy way. But if we don't do it the easy way, we're going to do it the hard way. And I'm a man, and by the way, I'm a fan of Denmark too, I have to tell you. And they've been very nice to me. I'm a big fan, but you know, the fact that they had a boat land there 500 years ago doesn't mean that they own the land. I'm sure we had lots of boats go there also, but we need that because if you take a look outside of Greenland right now, there are Russian destroyers, there are Chinese destroyers and bigger. There are Russian submarines all over the place. We're not going to have Russia or China occupy Greenland, and that's what they're going to do if we don't. So we're going to be doing something with Greenland, either the nice way or the more difficult way.
We're not going to have Russia as our neighbor, says President Trump. There's the United States and Russia. We are 2.5 miles away from Russia. They are our neighbor, Dr. Paul. So I don't know if someone told President Trump that they already are our neighbor, but that's it. The hard way or the easy way is what President Trump said on Greenland. I'm not sure exactly what that means.
Okay, so how is it then maybe that Donald Trump got exactly what he wanted for a $0 cost here and actually no real action? I mean, it doesn't seem like it. Europe's threatening to disband NATO and get rid of us, but we all know that's not going to happen. We all know they can't afford NATO without us. They all know that we are NATO. Everybody knows that it's just a bunch of bullshit. And the French are like, we'll do this. The French, all you do is surrender. I think one time there was a you know, like a joint operation, and France surrendered to England. I mean, it's just, yeah. Hey, I'm making a joke, but you know what I'm saying. Like, they're not going to do anything. See, here's the thing. I always hesitate to give Trump this kind of credit. I know some of you don't think I do, but I do. And the reason is simple. I've seen so many times where, like, the next move seemed so obvious to me, and then he did something really stupid instead of the thing that was obvious that would have absolutely been useful and worked. However, I also say this about people. If someone has a track record of doing something, like they always, let's say that you just, let's make this really simple. You have a romantic partner in your life. You live together. They're your husband, your wife, your live-in boyfriend or girlfriend, whatever it is, right? And you every morning when that person sits down on the couch as they're getting ready to go live their life for the day to put their shoes on, they always put their left shoe on first. And if yours always puts the right shoe on, fine, change it. It's just a point, right? But they always did that. And then today when they came out, they sat down and they put it the left shoe on first like they always do. You wouldn't be surprised. What you would actually be surprised by is if they put their right shoe on first, because for the last 5 years of your lives together, you've watched them do it the other way. So you come to expect that people will do things they've done in the past. Does that make sense? Okay. If you ever read Art of the Deal, Trump making a bunch of noise about something, threatening to do something that he's never going to do, to drive an outcome and get what he wants at no cost or a lower cost than he was actually willing to pay, is absolutely putting your shoe on the same foot first every day. It is the vast majority of his deals outlined in that book. Used exactly that tactic. Even if he eventually paid money, he paid less. Like, his track record is, I make a bunch of noise to create the response that I want from the other side. That's like there's probably five planks to Art of the Deal, and that's plank one. Anything I can do that gets the other side to move before me so I can gauge what they're doing and lead them in the direction I want them to go. So how does that apply to this Greenland thing? It's the easy way or the hard way. We're going to invade it. We're not going to invade fucking Greenland militarily, right? Nothing's off the table means nothing's... Any smart politician would always say nothing's off the table, because you don't ever want the other side to know, like, he drew a hard line there, he won't do this thing. So we know he can get away with it, right? You just wouldn't do that. Well, what does Trump actually want? What does Trump actually want here? Again, if we want rare earth elements from Greenland and we're willing to develop them, it's not Venezuela. We can easily go in and make a deal with Greenland and say, hey, we want to lease this area and extract this lithium or whatever it is, and we can do that. We don't need it to be a territory to do that at all. We want military bases. We already have a couple. I'm sure if we wanted another one, they would be fine with it. Maybe not right at this moment, but sure. I mean, what is he actually saying he wants done? I want the island defended. That's what he's saying. Okay? So what's now happening? Like, an entire fleet of EU assets is being deployed to guard Greenland from the United States. Let me say it again. What did Trump say he wanted here? Greenland protected from whom? Russia and China. So if there's a combined fleet of EU assets now around Greenland to protect it from anybody, it's to protect it from can you see how maybe he got what he wanted just by running his mouth? And I know that's a really hard leap for some of you because you hate the guy so much. All I'm saying is patterns of behavior repeat. And when you've seen a pattern of behavior from someone in the past, especially when it's worked well for them, it is reasonable to assume that when you see something that looks just like it in the future and it seems to work out for them, that they were following their own pattern of behavior from the past and they always knew what the result would be. Do you really think that anybody in Europe actually believes that the United States is going to like send an amphibious unit to Greenland? Do you believe? No. But then they start talking shit because that's when you goat a politician, they're easier to get to talk shit to you than like a fellow seventh grader on the schoolyard. And once they talk shit, then they have to do something. And since it doesn't actually cost them their money to send a few ships, well, they'll do that and go, look what we did. We stood up to Trump. I'm just saying that might be what actually happened here. Doesn't mean I condone it. It just means I'm observing it. All right, let's go on and talk about dogs with Joel Riles and the problem with having somebody else train your dog for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress K9 and K9 Academy coming back at you again with another expert segment. And today I wanted to contrast and compare doing what they call a board and train with your dog versus training your dog yourself and the pros and cons of each. When I first started dog training, I basically would do anything anybody would pay me to do with their dogs. And so we did a couple of board and trains, and I very quickly realized we're not doing that anymore. Because what would basically happen, and a board and train, for those who aren't familiar, is you send your dog for 4 to 6 weeks to a trainer. They train the dog for you, then you come pick your dog up. And we did that. The problem that I realized really quickly on was that I would have the dog doing everything the client wanted it to do. I would spend like a day with the client making sure that they knew how to do everything that I had trained the dog to do. And within a couple of weeks, they're calling me complaining because the dog's not doing what they said anymore. And I start asking questions and realize they're not doing anything I told them to do, right? They're not doing all the stuff that I did to get the dog to do what it was doing. And so the dog basically just went, oh, I'm back home. I can go right back to doing all the stuff I used to do and not listen to these people anymore because I don't need to. So one of the things to be really cautious about if you do a board and train is to understand right off the bat that you are going to need to learn what training method they use, okay, at least enough that you can replicate it with your dog on a daily basis, and you have to maintain the dog's training and obedience. And I've found that people who send their dogs to places like that almost never do that, and then they're unhappy with the results because they didn't maintain the training that the handler put into it, right? Some of these people would even come back to me. I could literally take the lead, and the second I had the dog's lead in my hand, the dog was like, oh, I know who that guy is. I have to do what he says. It would foos up on me. It would do exactly what I said. I'd hand the lead right back to them, and the dog wanted to test him immediately, like on the field. And then when they started actually correcting the dog again, when they started following my procedures, the dog would come back into obedience. And if you don't do that, you're not going to be able to maintain the obedience of the dog. So what do I recommend? So we just had, I don't think she'd mind me using her name here, Sarah Whitkind and her husband were here. They had a dog that they were having some behavioral issues with. And they came and we spent a couple of days training on the facility. And I trained them exactly how I train people with Canine Academy. I rarely touch another person's dog. I might grab the lead and demonstrate something for them so they can see what it looks like so that when they're doing it, they can better mimic it. But 90% of the training is do this with your dog. Now do this with your dog. Now fix this. Now stop doing that. Right? And I'm walking them through how to properly handle their dog. And when you handle a dog properly, what you're actually doing is training the dog to behave the way that you want it to train. And you are always training your dog. Everything you do with your dog is training your dog. You're either training them that something is okay, or you're training them that something is not okay, or you're just letting the dog make decisions and you're training the dog that you can just do whatever you want right now. Right? You're always training your dog. My recommendation, and not everybody wants to go to this level, but is your dog should always be in obedience. If your dog is roaming the house, it's because I told my dog it's okay to roam the house right now. Then I can say, okay, now go to your place. It's no longer okay to roam the house. I want you to lay in your place. Now, let's go. Come to me. I want you to come to me now. Everything I do with my dogs is under obedience. The only times my dogs are not under obedience is when they're either in a kennel or a crate or on a tie-out. And on those three locations, which they're being restrained in the places they can go, they can kind of do whatever they want in there as long as they're not trying to eat their way out of a crate or escape a kennel. And as long as they're comfortable in there, they can kind of run around, they can chew on their toys, they can kind of do whatever. But then as soon as they come out of that, we're back into obedience. I may walk outside and let my dog run around, but it's because I tell them, okay, you're free, go on. And then I let them run around for a few minutes, and then I call them back to me. If they don't come back to me and they take advantage of that freedom I've given them, they lose that freedom, and I take it away from them for a little while, and then we'll give them another chance to have that freedom again after a couple of weeks of obedience. All right? So when you go to Canine Academy and you're going through the training at Canine Academy, one of the reasons Jack mentions when he does the ads for Canine Academy is I'm teaching you how to train your dog, is because if you don't learn how to train your dog, even if someone else does the training for you, when the dog comes back to you, you will very quickly lose the vast majority of what that handler or that trainer did for you, because you don't understand what you need to do to properly handle your dog. When you go through the process yourself and you do the training yourself, now you also know how to fix the things, because usually what happens is you get really good obedience, you kind of start to slack off because, okay, you know, it takes some time and energy and mental focus, and so I start to slack off, oh, my dog's starting to do things that annoy me, I need to do it again, but I'm just doing the same thing I did last time to get the obedience back in the dog, and now my obedience is good again. It usually takes much less time this time around because the dog already knows. They're just learning, oh, okay, yep, I took it too far. Now we're back into discipline mode. Got it. And then you're good to go. You already know how to fix most of your own problems because you were the one that did the training with the dog in the first place. And this is also going to help you the next time you get a dog and the next time you get a dog. You already kind of know what to do. Maybe you need to go get a refresher a little bit and stuff like that. But you have a really good understanding and expectation of what the dog is supposed to do, what you're supposed to do, and how you work together as a team. So I highly recommend learning to train your dog yourself as opposed to taking the quote-unquote easy route and paying someone else to do it for you, especially if they're not going to teach you for at least a day how to do all the stuff that they taught the dog to do so that you can maintain it and keep it going once you get home. I hope that's been helpful for you. If you want more details on how to train your own dog, check out Canine Academy. Go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, click on the banner, and check out our different options we have for you there. And if you're interested in getting a working line puppy or a fully trained protection dog, we have Belgian Malinois, German Shepherds, and Dutch Shepherds. Our working dogs are working dogs, but they are not high-strung, crazy dogs like the sport line dogs. Our dogs are trained to function in a household, to be good around your kids and your other pets. They're solid dogs. They're stable. They know when not to bite, and they only bite when there's actually a threat to you or your family. And so if you're interested in one of those, reach out to us at fortresscanine.com. Click on the consult button and send me a message, or you can text me at 813-836-9244. And if you are interested in a puppy, I'm not sure if this will air before the deadline, but if you mention these ads before the end of the year, I'll extend it out for people who mention this ad. We are taking $500 off our puppies. We have a couple puppies still on ground, and we have a couple litters coming up. So it applies to the reservations on those upcoming litters as well. We give you a year of the Advanced Canine Academy course so you can do the training that we do and get your puppy just how you want it so that it functions in your life. And those are $500 off through the end of the year if you mention this ad. And you can check that out at fortresscanine.com/puppies and get all the details on our puppies there. Okay, I hope that's been helpful for you. And until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
As far as dogs go, I have nothing to add to that. I just do think, especially right now, where so many people have so many issues in their life that they're so quick to assign the blame to someone else for, that it usually comes back to the most impactful things in your life are based on the things that you do or don't do, including how you handle a dog that has been properly trained, but you became the substitute teacher that the kids sized up in the first 5 minutes of class and went, we can get away with anything with this one. And it's actually easier for a dog to pull that off than a class full of kids. I'm just going to say it, right? Because dogs are, we love them. But sometimes when you love something, you also have to hold it to a standard. Moving on, let's hear from Mike Molito on restoring older guns. I'm looking forward to this one. He said, like I said, when I screened it briefly, that I would probably have some ads. I expect to, but I'm going to listen to what he has to say first.
Hey, TSP. Got a question here about restoring old guns. There's a lot in this topic, so I'm going to try and keep it concise and in a short format for the expert counsel question. And I'm sure Jack will have quite a bit to add on to this. Gentleman inherited a bunch of guns, which is a great thing to have. And he says a lot of them have surface rust on them, a couple of them so much so I can't even make out the manufacturer name or model number. Okay, so he says some of them are 80 years old or more. Okay, so let's get into this. I come at this from a practical shooting standpoint, not a collector standpoint. I am not a collector, I would say. I'm not worried about, you know, that. I'm trying to get things usable. Okay, a couple of things here I'm going to start out with. Much like painting, when you're restoring an old gun, prep work goes a long way. So make sure you spend your time prepping. the material, like removing the stock, removing any pieces that you might damage when you're doing the treatment for refinishing the gun. The first thing you're going to want to do is try and get that rust off. So you can do that with steel wool and oil. You can also do that, if it's really bad, by soaking it in Simple Green. That's my old trick we used to use when we had really dirty guns. You can soak in Simple Green. If you've separated all the parts and it's just a metal part, soak it for, you know, overnight in Simple Green. That can really help get some of that, break that rust up. You can also, if you have a bunch of like WD-40, you can soak it in there. Really kind of break some of that stuff down, and light passes with the steel wool. You can use sandpaper. I prefer steel wool. Sandpaper will work, and kind of get that down and get it what they call, you know, in the white. Get some of that old finish off. Almost all of these older guns you have, unless it was a military gun that's parkerized, are probably going to be blued. Now there are a couple of products. There's the Perma Blue, the cold bluing techniques. If you're asking me about this, you probably don't have a hot bluing tank. And obviously, if you're taking it somewhere, they're going to do what they're going to do. But for you, there's really cold blue, and there's the cold blue liquid, and there's the cold blue paste. For something larger, like the barrel, cold blue paste is good. Read the instructions. You know, use small passes on it. You might do several coats of it. For the smaller parts, you may want to do the cold blue liquid, and it's a lot easier on the smaller parts. So you might look at that for the cold blue. If you want bluing, if you want to make them look kind of original. I'm not the biggest fan of bluing to begin with. I'm a stainless steel guy when I can get it. And although we've hit a plateau in firearms manufacturing, one of the things we do have is better finishes. Now, a lot of those finishes, like Duracoat, or Cerakote. Cerakote's like a highly technical process that you probably don't have the stuff to do if you're asking me this question. If you know how to do that, it's a professional grade job, that's great, but it's quite expensive if you're going to do a lot of guns. But there are several products you can use at home that work pretty well. I've used a lot of them. One of them is Brownell's Alumahide. Don't let the name fool you. It's for more than just aluminum. It works on most metals. It works on wood. It works on plastic. The Alumahide is like an epoxy spray paint that's better than spray paint. When you spray it on, it like mixes, and it's a really, really durable finish for what it is. They make it in several colors. Again, if you want original, go with a black finish. But that's a much more durable finish, I think, than the bluing, if you want to go that route. There are some other ones. Durabake, Duracoat, Ceramicoat. Ceramicoat's a real good one. Some of those come in a lot of different color variations, but all of them will come in black, I believe. Something I may say that may make some of the, you know, higher end collectors gasp is something I use quite a bit is just spray paint. And I beat my guns up. I use them. I compete with them. It's not uncommon for me to spray paint a lot of my go-to hard use guns. The high temperature, like grill paint, Krylon or other brands that are really tough high temperature paints, I actually think they do a better job and they're easy to apply than some of the old blue. Now, it's not going to look original. If you want the original, you go the cold bluing technique, but like a gloss or a semi-gloss, high temperature, really durable, like grill spray paint, is a really durable, rugged finish. A lot of it has rust inhibitor. So if it's got rust on it already, if you do a halfway decent job of knocking that off and you put this paint on there, it can do a pretty decent job of stopping the future rust. Whereas sometimes you do cold blue and it'll just rust through again. So I know that may make some people gasp, but that high temperature, really durable black spray paint, like the oven paint, grill paint, try it on something else first. It's not a firearm. See how you like it. But it can be a really, really durable, rugged, easy finish. There is also rust converter. If you have some that aren't really that bad and you want to keep most of the original look, you can just wipe them down with the rust converter, see how it looks, and then just a sheen of some kind of good gun oil, CLP or Ballistol or something. And since I mentioned Ballistol, moving on to stocks and leather and things like that on old guns, you should look at Ballistol if you're going to restore old stocks. Also, True Oil is really good, and boiled linseed oil is good for those old wood stocks. A lot of times just sanding them down and hitting them with True Oil or boiled linseed oil is pretty much all that's necessary in an old wood stock. They can take a lot of beating as long as they're not cracked or anything like that. The other thing I want to say before I turn this over to Jack, I'm sure he's going to have comments, is if you think any of them are so badly damaged and pitted that they're dangerous, obviously take those to a competent gunsmith. And I want to say, do no harm, right? If you want, if these are a collector gun, or if you're listening and you're not the person to ask the question, you know, a word of caution, if you somehow inherit like a 1873 Colt Peacemaker, don't take steel wool and cold blue to it. Take it to a collector or a professional restorer. You'll probably do a lot more damage to the value than you will if you try and restore it yourself. But if you're not worried about collector value and just making them more usable and presentable, then those techniques I mentioned and the ones that Jack's probably going to mention. Start out on your least valuable one first. Try it. You may really like it. It's something you can really get into, especially this time of year in the winter, restoring your old guns that have gotten a little beat up. Thanks, TSB. Thanks, Jack. I'm sure I will learn as well from Jack's add-on to this. Have a blessed day.
He did a really great job with this. I don't have a ton to add on the practice itself of restoring guns, especially guns that mostly the biggest problem it sounds like these guns have is rust. They just weren't cared for. They have a bunch of rust on them. You got to get the rust off. If the rust has gone deep enough that it takes bluing, you got to do something to replace it. And then you got to decide, am I doing it myself? Am I taking it to a shop? And also the do no harm. That's what I was waiting to hear. Like, there are some things that you shouldn't do. There are some so-called problems that you shouldn't fix, and you should know what you're doing when you do that. And you should also know that guns that people look at today and go, oh, it'll never be worth nothing, we all remember people saying that about guns in the past. I've told the story before, but I remember being in like 11th grade, 10th or 11th grade, and there was a store, like a discount store, kind of like a Walmart before Walmart was big, at least was before Walmart was a thing in Pennsylvania. Like an anchor store to a small second-tier mall is what this was. It was called Lane Co. And they had all the stuff, the women's clothes, the men's clothes, the hardware, the bicycles, the sporting goods. It was like a Sears, I guess, more than a Walmart, right? Like old-school Sears, but smaller. And I walk in there one day, and they have these guns, like a whole bunch of them. And they look old as shit. And what they were is 30 carbines, M1s. The pistol caliber one. It's not really a pistol caliber. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? The M1 carbines, not the M1As. They fired a 30 carbine round, which was considered to be underpowered for deer-sized game and overpowered for something like a squirrel or a rabbit. But they're fun as shit to shoot, and the reality is with proper bullet selection, they are quite useful for many things. They were $78. When they were putting them up on the shelf, they were unwrapping them from brown paper that was wrapped with Cosmoline on them. They had never been issued. Do you know what those are worth today? And yes, it was 1987, I guess, you know, and $78 was a lot more money than it is today. It wasn't that much. It wasn't that much. I mean, to put it in perspective, you know, I worked in a grocery store when I was a teenager, and I made about $250 a week. So it was less than half a week's pay for a kid working in a grocery store. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, like that was a really affordable thing, and I didn't buy any. We all probably also remember the days of buying, you know, three of the AKs, the Yugo AKs, for like $150. Or the days when you could buy for, you know, under $200, you could buy like a 3-pack of Swedish 6.5 Mausers. So I'm just going to say, like, if you're talking about something with real collectability in it, it may be at least better to have somebody that's a professional appraise it before you start trying to quote unquote fix it. Because some things are worth more money the way they are than after you quote unquote fixed it or Bubba-ized it either. Okay. Though I don't fault anybody for turning a military surplus weapon into a really great hunting rifle if that's what you do. I'm just saying, know what you're doing when you do it. The other thing I wanted to point out with this whole thing is sometimes you do get your hands on milsurp. And one of the big issues with that, if it's never been taken care of, is the cosmoline I just talked about. It's one thing on the metal, but it soaks into the stocks and into the wood, and it will, you know, after you think you've got it all, it will weep out and it will cause problems and it's nasty. And so I have actually done quite a few military SERP, kind of not really refurbished, but just really clean and put into to action mode, let's say. And what I've always done is remove the wood and then take the wood and put it inside a black plastic garbage bag in the sun, but lift it off the ground so the bag kind of hangs. And that heat will literally bake the, you got it, right now it's not a good time to do this. In the sun, in the summer, it will bake the, and you take it out and you wipe it down and you put it back in and you keep doing that. And it, you will be surprised. I mean, I would bet that the average Yugo SK, because I bought a bunch of those when they were coming into the country originally, I bet you there was almost a pound of cosmoline in the wood. So that would be a little addition that I have, you know. And if you can be really just kind of like a little bit of, you know, W-40 or some gun oil or something and take service rust off and kind of leave it alone, a lot of times that's all it's really done. Then the other thing is, you know, there is this quest that people have. Like, this guy inherited guns. This is different. But where people go to gun shows and they're specifically looking for old, pitted, rusted, messed up guns to get as a deal, and they think they're going to bring them home and restore them, and that makes the deal even better. It's a thing. It's not. But usually it fails. Usually it fails. Usually those guns are over-damaged. By the time you're done with all the work and effort, you could have bought something a lot nicer and ended up with a better final product. Or you did what I said and you took something collectible and you actually diminished its collector's value to be a mediocre example of the weapon. Be careful with that. All right, with that, let's keep going here. And who do we have next? We have Doc Bones talking about eye infections. And this can be life-altering if not properly handled when there is no higher level of care than you.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning 4th edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Also, by the way, giving out important medical information on Jack's channel for more than 10 years. I think if you ask people what sense they would least like to lose of the 5 senses in the quest for survival, it would be the sense of sight, right? That makes sense. I rarely discuss vision issues off the grid, but let's talk about some of that today. How about eye infections? There are various eye conditions that would be more common in a grid-down situation, and the most common infection would be conjunctivitis, also known as pink eye. The conjunctiva is the thin membrane that covers the white of your eye. Conjunctivitis is inflammation which can be caused by chemical irritation, soap in your eyes, for example, allergies, a foreign body, or an infection. Pink eye caused by microbes is highly contagious among children especially. They tend to rub their itchy eye and then touch other children or items. Studies have shown that people commonly touch faces and eyes with their often dirty hands throughout the day. If you observe any family member for a half hour, you'll see this is true. Symptoms of conjunctivitis can vary depending on the cause, whether it's viral, bacterial, allergic, or chemical irritant. Common ones include redness or pink color in the white of one or both eyes, itching, irritation, or a gritty, sandy feeling in the eyes, excessive tearing, watery eyes, discharge from the eye, which may be watery or may be thick and pus-like. Usually in bacterial infections, it might be yellow or green, or it could be crusty, causing the eyelids to stick together, especially in the morning. You might see swelling of the conjunctiva or the eyelids. You may feel burning or discomfort in the eyes, sensitivity to light, and in some cases, blurred vision. So how to treat conjunctivitis? Although antibiotic eye drops like tobramycin are more popular for conjunctivitis in modern times, oral antibiotics in your survival medicine cabinet, like doxycycline 100 milligrams twice a day for a week or less, will also relieve bacterial conjunctivitis. Antihistamine eye drops, like Zatidor, are useful for eye allergies and they're also available over the counter. Warm compresses can loosen hardened crusts. Herbal treatment may also be a benefit. To treat pink eye using natural products, you might consider one of the following methods. You apply a wet chamomile or golden seal tea bag to the closed affected eye for about 10 minutes every 2 hours. You can also make a chamomile or eye bright tea, let cool, and then use the liquid as an eye wash using an eye cup 3 or 4 times daily. You can also use maybe 1 teaspoon of baking soda and 2 cups of cool water as an eye wash solution. You can also, as an eye wash solution, dissolve 1 tablespoon of raw honey in 1 cup of warm water. Let it cool and then use it. For compresses, use any of the teas, baking soda, or honey solutions on gauze or cloth, and then apply a compress to the affected eye for 10 minutes every 2 hours. For relief from the discomfort of the conjunctivitis, a slice of cucumber over the eyes will have a cooling effect. If no treatment options exist at all, though, conjunctivitis usually will resolve on its own after a few days, but it could take up to 2 weeks. Irritated, teary, red eyes from allergies, they can be treated with oral antihistamines or eye drops, and which are important additions to the survival medicine cabinet. Lubricating drops for dryness may help. To prevent conjunctivitis, you want to avoid spreading the germs, right? So wash your hands regularly. Don't share eye drops with other people. Don't touch the tip of a bottle of eye drops with your hands or your eyes because that can contaminate it with germs. Always keep the bottle about 2 or 3 inches above your eye as you're applying the eye drops. Don't share eye makeup with others. I never do. That's a joke, son. Never put contact lenses in your mouth to wet them. A lot of people do that. Many germs exist there that can cause infections. And change your contacts often. The longer they stay in your eyes, the higher the chance your eye can get infected or traumatized. By the way, anytime you have an eye examination, make sure you ask the doctor if they have any samples of medicated eye drops available, like tobramycin, polymyxin B, or neomycin. You want to apply 1 or 2 drops to the affected eye 3 times a day for 5 to 7 days. Now let's talk about styes. A stye is a bump on the eyelid. It represents, I guess, a pimple that can be outside or inside. Styes are caused by a blocked gland near an eyelash due to an accumulation of bacteria called Staphylococcus aureus, or staph. Luckily, styes do not affect vision unless they become very large, which is a rarity. Normally, they tend to grow, pop, and drain, then go away after a few days. Despite this, there's often a sense of urgency to deal with it because of the discomfort and, well, the cosmetic appearance. Symptoms of a stye include swelling, often with a yellowish bump at the base of an eyelash, redness, warmth, discomfort, and discharge and crusting around the area. Now, a stye is sometimes confused with another condition called a chalazion. A chalazion is caused by the blockage of an eyelid gland duct that excretes an oily substance which lubricates the eye. Styes develop quickly, but a chalazion forms over a longer period, sometimes in the area of a previous stye. Unlike styes, a chalazion is painless, but just as disfiguring. A chalazion might resolve on its own over a period of weeks or months, but it might not. The simplest way to treat a stye is to apply warm, moist compresses for 10 minutes, about 2 or 3 times a day. This helps the stye drain faster and go away. In between, you want to clean gently with a cotton ball or swab in warm water. Antibiotic eye solutions and ointments are also available that will help to speed recovery. Use acetaminophen or ibuprofen for pain relief if you really need it. If a patient gets styes often, it's time to evaluate their hand washing practices. Most people don't wash their hands as often as they should, and this can cause infections like styes or, as I mentioned before, pink eye. This is especially an issue for those who wear contacts. A good method of prevention is to perform eyelid scrubs regularly with a warm, moist cotton ball or gauze pad and a small amount of baby shampoo. Now, many people will try to squeeze the stye like any other pimple, but this can traumatize the area and can spread the infection to surrounding tissues. This is called cellulitis and is discussed in our book, The Survival Medicine Handbook, The Essential Guide for When Help Is Not on the Way. If the cellulitis spreads to the face, you should give your patient oral antibiotics in the penicillin, erythromycin, or cephalosporin families. Natural remedies for styes include warm saline solution washes or compresses several times a day, coriander or tamarind seed washes to reduce swelling, soak the seeds in warm water, then strain them, and use the water as the wash. Warm tea bags in the area are helpful. The tannic acid in teas also something that will help with the inflammation. Okay, this is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, keep your family medically prepared with quality medical kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. That's store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
Good stuff from Doc Bones, and a lot to think about there. Let's now hear from Ryan Steva on Homestead Automation with some additional things you can do to assure privacy of some of the equipment used in this is things that make you have some privacy concerns.
Hey everyone, Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today I'm going to cover practical homestead automation with some smart devices. And if smart devices scare you, stick with till the end. I have some ways to protect your privacy when using these systems. On a homestead, the biggest problems usually don't happen when you're watching. A pump runs dry, a freezer fails, equipment gets stolen, or a brooder gets too cold. By the time you notice, you're already dealing with dead animals, rotten food, damaged or lost equipment. Unfortunately, most simple automation systems have three major downsides. They have limited range, they're internet reliant, and they have major privacy concerns. Today, I wanted to talk about a practical way to automate and secure your homestead while using a long-range, low-power system that can continue to work even when the power goes down. The specific system that I'm using is a system called Yolink. Many of you may already be using this, as I know Nicole Sauce has recommended it in the past for freezer monitoring, but it can do so much more if you understand some of the basics. So at its core, automation, and in our case, homestead automation, is as simple as only three things: sensors, switches or relays, and alerts. The key difference between systems that work well on a homestead and ones that don't is range and reliability. Long-range radio systems like LoRa can communicate over 1,000 feet, up to 1/4 mile in this case, without Wi-Fi. They can run for years on standard alkaline batteries and continue to operate even if the internet is down. Once you understand the pattern, sense, switch, notify, implementation becomes a matter of your imagination. For example, water systems. Yolink sensors, like float switches, can tell you when a tank is full or when the levels drop too low. The signal can automatically shut off the pump, turn one on, or send you a notification. This means you don't have to stand there watching tanks fill, and you won't risk burning out pumps or overflowing storage tanks. The same idea applies anywhere water can cause problems, monitoring for leaks, triggering sump pumps, or alerting you when something isn't right. There are also leak sensors, temperature monitors, and inline valves. So I'm sure some of you aquaponics nerds out there can come up with all kinds of additional uses for water systems. Another major use case is temperature and humidity control, especially when it comes to animal care. Sensors can monitor conditions inside brooders, coops, or other shelters. When temperatures rise too high or drop too low, fans, heaters, and heat lamps can automatically be turned on or off as needed. As animals grow or seasons change, you simply adjust the set points. No rewiring, no hardware changes are required. You can also set alerts so that if conditions move outside of a safe range, you know immediately. Freezers and refrigerators are another high-value area. A small temperature sensor inside a freezer can alert you if temperatures rise unexpectedly due to power outages or equipment failure. You can also use the same setup to turn a chest freezer into a refrigerator. With this system, instead of discovering the problem hours or days later, you get notified right away and can take action before food is lost. For most homesteads, this kind of monitoring is a very inexpensive insurance policy. Yolink can also be used for securing your homestead. So motion sensors, door sensors, smart switches, they can all be used together to turn on lights, trigger alerts, or both when movement is detected at a given boundary. Imagine if rather than a stationary motion sensing light, you placed a wireless motion sensor at all of your gates at human height, and if one was tripped, you could turn on all the floodlights on your property, or you can send an alert to your phone, or what if you could send an alert to your phone if someone opened a door on a shed or a barn that's 1/4 mile away and doesn't have electricity? With this system, you can trigger anything to happen. turn on any light, sound an alarm, send a notification, etc. I've set this system up at the entry of a hip camp location so that when the guest passes through the gate, it turns on a light system. And this light system then not only alerts the host that someone is there, it also gives light for the person arriving so that they can get their luggage and go to their location. Because Yolink systems don't rely on short-distance Wi-Fi coverage, they work well at outbuildings, coops, gates, and areas far from the house. Now, privacy for this community I know is a big concern, so let me talk about a couple of ways that you can increase your privacy. First of all, the hub is the connection point for the Yolink system. So all of the devices talk to the hub, and then the hub talks on the internet. If you can isolate the hub from the other devices on your network, that isolates it from being able to collect and report on data from your network. There's two main ways to do this. One is you can set up a secondary router firewall. This could be some old router that still works that's sitting in your closet that you don't use for your day-to-day purposes anymore. And you just put the Yolink device behind that, and that becomes something that allows for internet through to the Yolink hub, but doesn't allow the Yolink hub to talk to the other things on the network. You can also isolate the hub or any other smart device for that matter that uses Wi-Fi by using guest mode on your Wi-Fi. The guest mode basically stops any of the devices from talking to each other or being able to see each other on the network. In conclusion, by automating the most common failure points, you reduce the potential for damage and loss, and you can spend more time on things that can't be automated. Once the systems are in place, they quietly do their job in the background, alerting you when something actually needs your time. But a word of caution on this is not to lean too heavily on the automation. If you set systems up right, they can serve as early warnings and help maintain consistency, but don't become complacent or ignore something simply because it's automated. If you want to help me, I'll include a link for Jack to put in the show notes to my Amazon storefront, and specifically to a spot on the storefront where I'm going to have a list of Yolink devices that you can look through so you can see if they are functional for your purposes. If you want help setting up Homestead automation systems or anything else Homestead related, feel free to reach out to me at thehomesteadconsultant.com. You can find all my contact information there. And of course, until next time, go get your hands dirty.
Great stuff there. And I do have the link to the video he mentioned and to his shopping list on Amazon in the show notes for today. Just go to the survivalpodcast.com. If you're listening to it, you know, right after publish, it'll be near the top. Otherwise, you want to look for episode 3788 to find those resources if you're listening to us in the future from the past, right? Anyway, next up, we got one more before my segment today. This is John Pogliano with kind of a lightning round of investment questions heading into 2026.
Hello, TSP. Happy New Year. Going to start off 2026 with a lightning round of questions. First question from Martin. He mentions, you know, the popular trend about the need for energy and extraction of not only energy, but rare earth materials and all the different minerals and things that's in the news right now. And he's looking to invest in these areas. Martin, I do think this is a real trend. I've been talking about it really for more than a decade now. Even if you go back to the book where I talked about the robots are coming, the emphasis I talked about in there was not only the need for energy, but also the United States specifically and North America more generally, their competitive advantage they have on inexpensive natural gas. I won't get into all that now, but I'm a big proponent of the energy trade, and my portfolio includes all the nuts and bolts of that energy trade, you know, whether it's owning copper mines, or traditional utility companies, or uranium mining or refining companies, the distribution system, again, the nuts and bolts, whether it's owning a company that makes the flow valves for petroleum and natural gas pipelines, or whether it's owning an electric or electronic switching or cabling company. You know, I want to own a piece of all those things And to your question, you specifically reference some stocks like Lithium Americas or an ETF that's more comprehensive like UUUU. Hey, bottom line, again, I want to own a diversified portfolio of all these. I don't want to put all my eggs in one basket, whether it's just an ETF or a specific stock. And I'll just a quick example. Right now, everybody's all crazy about what's going on in Venezuela and the energy service companies like Halliburton, Baker Hughes. You know, they're all up, I don't know, maybe double digits at this point. I'm not running out to buy those companies because I already own them, right? They're already in my portfolio. A year or more when I bought them, did I know that we were going to have the kind of situation we do with Venezuela right now? No, I didn't know the specifics of it, but I knew enough to look at the aging petroleum fields, you know, whether they be in Russia, Ukraine, Venezuela, or other parts of the world that have been neglected, and knowing that at some point they're going to have to be rebuilt or refurbished. And I wanted to be part of that trade. And I, again, didn't go out and just buy one stock. I own all three of the major oil service companies. I want to follow the trends, but I also want diversification. Okay, next question, Nick. Nick has a bunch of cash. He's wondering if he should invest some or all of that cash into a high dividend portfolio that would generate some income and then take out a, like a car loan and use that income to pay the car off, or whether he should just, you know, buy the car or make a bigger down payment on the car. Hey, Nick, there's all kinds of ways to slice and dice this. And if you follow the Substacks and the influencers and the nerd wallets, and, you know, they get in all these convoluted ways about how you can borrow and be like the rich fat cats that get rich off of other people's money. And I don't know. I got to tell you, I've been investing for over 40 years. If you know my mantra, it's earn, save, invest. You'll notice it's just those three words. It doesn't say anything about debt. I'm not opposed to debt when it's used properly, as in buying a quality home that's in an appreciating neighborhood, you know, because you got to live somewhere anyways. So it makes sense to use debt to purchase the right type of home. Or if you want to be a real estate investor and you want to use debt to finance that, you know what you're doing. Or if you have a great business idea and you need debt to scale up your business, hey, I'm all for that. But whether it's margin or other debt instruments to invest in stocks or some other type unsecured loan, no, I'm not for it. I think it's too risky. It may work out just fine for you, but keep in mind, quote, high yield dividend portfolio, you use that term. You have to be really careful. If you have a stock that's paying 6 or 8% dividends when the 10-year treasury is only paying 4, you got to ask yourself why. Well, obviously, it's that way for a reason. There must be a lot of risk. And just because a company has been paying a dividend for 30 years doesn't mean that it won't cut that dividend. I've got a stock in my portfolio, Celanese. They're a chemical company. They had no risk of going bankrupt, but you know what? They've slashed their dividend because they're in hard times right now. It's just the way it is. You also mentioned you use ChatGPT to construct the portfolio. Hey, Nick, I'll just say you've got a lot more faith in ChatGPT than I do. My general advice is that debt is slavery, and just like slavery, you want to avoid unnecessary debt to the extent that you can. Okay, next question from Zeb. Sort of a similar question, but different. He's asking about, in his Roth, if he should just be, if I understand his question properly, you know, just investing in regular old zero-fee general stock market ETFs, or whether he should be looking at an alternative way to invest in Bitcoin through something like Strategy Strike, which is a convertible preferred stock that pays a dividend. Now, he also mentions that he owns Bitcoin, and then he talks about this as an indirect way. Zeb, it's a lot about risk, how much risk you want to take on. If you just look at, you know, whether you look at Strike or whether you look at strategies, just stock in general, yeah, you can try and make more money or get income out of it through dividends and convertible stock, but I don't know. It's a whole lot simpler just to own the underlying asset if you believe in it. The other part of your question about, you know, in your 401k, it sounds like you have a good chunk in just a large cap index fund, and then you have gold, silver, Bitcoin, you know, in other holdings. Yeah, for someone your age, I think that's, you know, a pretty diversified strategy. You got the traditional market. You got some asymmetrical players in there with the Bitcoin and precious metals. Long term, it should all do just fine. Okay, next question from Matt. He has a 401k plan, and he's asking if he should just contribute to that to get the match and then take the other amount that he would be putting in his 401k and opening up a Roth for him and his wife. Well, Matt, double check with your company. You know, a lot of 401ks have now gone to 401k Roths. And with a Roth, as you know, I can tell by your question, the way you're asking it, Roth tax-free is always better than tax-deferred. So I would get the money into a Roth one way or another, whether it was either your individual Roth or a Roth through a corporate 401k plan. And it seems like the underlying question that you have, though, is you're asking about the compounding effect. You know, you're a little worried about, you know, hey, if I open up this smaller account that only has, you know, $7,000-$8,000 into it, is it going to have less of a compounding effect as opposed to my big 401k portfolio, which has, you know, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars in it? Matt, as an individual investor, there shouldn't be a compounding effect difference. In my world of money management, there can be on smaller accounts. But that's only because if I have a larger account, I can slice and dice it in more ways, you know, for greater diversification. You know, my particular portfolios, I don't know, own right now 135, 140 different individual stocks or different positions. I'd be hard pressed to be able to do that with only $5,000, especially as a professional investor, they don't let me buy fractional shares. You as an individual investor can buy fractional shares. And also, since you're in a 401k, you're probably limited to just a bunch of index funds anyways. So in your case, assuming you're taking the same investment approach with your smaller Roth account or your larger 401k, really shouldn't make any difference. Okay, out of time. Hey, again, Happy New Year. This is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealth Standing Podcast.
All right, good stuff from John. I agree mostly with that. I have some differential there on not so much what he's saying, but how things get lumped together. So like a high dividend paying stock paying 6 to 8%. If it's actually a stock and they're paying it out of their profits, then okay, sure. But if you're talking about a specific investment vehicle that is built to pay a high dividend like Strike or Stride, which is part of the portfolio coming out of Strategy that is Michael Saylor, those have math that vets out and checks. And the reason they're paying the high dividends isn't because they have to. It's because they effing can. And the ones that can pay the higher amount can attract more raw capital. And in the case of Strike, or Stride, they have the ability to run for like 32 years if Bitcoin goes to like 10% of its current value and stays there for the next 30 years. That's math. Here's the thing. When we look at things like that, not necessarily ABC stock or something like that, we should be asking a different question, in my opinion. And that is, how the hell are things like standard bonds that pay somewhere between 4 and 6% going to compete with that going forward into the future? Because it's going to be very difficult for them, if not impossible. But otherwise, you know, okay, take it for what it is. And then the leveraging of assets. Like, I agree that if you're like leveraged up at 50% loan to value so that you can buy more stock in something else or another asset, that's dumb. The formula, though, of taking a pristine asset used as collateral like Bitcoin in your retirement and rolling on like a 3% loan to value ratio in perpetuity, taking loans at 6 to 8% on an asset that's going to appreciate somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 50% per annum across 5 years, you can do that forever. And again, the math vets that. And the rich people really have been doing this forever, primarily using real estate. The difference is, with Bitcoin, the terms are now about the same in cost relative to equity. But the other side of it is you don't have to worry about maintenance and, you know, property taxes and all the other things that go with real estate. The downside is you can't use other people's money to buy it the way you can with real estate. Anyway, let's talk about my thing today, which, again, I want to talk again about the protests that are going on. Not about the girl that got shot individually at all, again, like I did on Monday. That guy's the ones you all wound up or whatever. The back row, the protests themselves, in a different way than you might think. Like, if I just titled this as a video and put it on YouTube or something, people would tune in expecting to see something totally different than they would get. And that is, the ICE protests are a precision weaponization of useful idiots. In other words, they're being done. I could say, call this segment the ICE protests are a brilliant tactic. Now, you see, you can have a, see, oh, I thought you didn't like them. I don't like them, either the people behind it or the people actively doing it. But you can look at, you know, war history and say, in this particular instance, the military strategy employed by Germany's generals in World War II was a brilliant tactic. It doesn't mean that they were good guys, right? You can go into any situation. You can look at, you know, anything from the Crusades to the days of Roman legions to the Mongol hordes and everything in between and before and after. And you can always find brilliant tactics being used by bad people. So don't get the wrong idea when I say that, but it is brilliant. And it's brilliant, and the brilliance is why a lot of you don't understand what's happening. You don't get what's going on. So what you have to realize is that, first of all, Americans in general, and I would say people who have life pretty good in general, right? People that overall their life is pretty good tend to really want a good underdog story. We love underdog stories. If there is two teams playing and you don't know anything about the sport and you don't know anything about the teams, but you know the one team is supposed to lose, you kind of feel good when you see them start to win. Right, we just like that. We are for the individual. We're for the little person. We have this, you know, desire to feel good about, you know, the David overcoming the Goliath. And let's ignore the fact that the sling used by David was the equivalent of a fucking modern rifle that he shot Goliath in the head with. Right, we'll just throw that out because we want to believe in this, like this tiny little thing standing up to the big bad man. And so if you can create that perception, even subconsciously in people, you are already, if you want to sell your side, and you're selling your side as the David versus the Goliath, you're already to the point where you can take about 51% of the people with you. You already have a majority opinion with people having no knowledge of what's actually going on. And then if you can feed them some false knowledge that they take in as being true knowledge, then you have even more of that. And this is what I mean by that. There are so many people out there saying some version of the following, including many of you guys have heard from you. I don't necessarily object to deportations, especially of the people that are criminals and doing really bad things like defrauding the people with fraud or committing real crimes as though entering the country illegally is not a crime. Fine, okay, I'll let you go. And they say all this stuff and they come to this final conclusion. I don't necessarily object to people being deported. I don't like the way it's being done. Okay? And there's a whole bunch of you out there nodding your head right now going, that's me. That's me. Hold on. What do you know about what's being done and what is your source of the information of what's being done? Subconsciously, whether you realize it or not, what's playing in your head over and over is a series of newsreels and clips of U.S. federal agents wearing helmets and flak jackets and riot gear and carrying not just firearms but also carrying things like pepper cannons and stuff like that. And you constantly are seeing that imagery of all the little poor protesters and these big, you know, super amped up armed dudes. Okay? And so that has become in your brain what deportation looks like. This is not what deportation looks like. You're seeing almost no acts at all on your TV of actual deportation operations. That's not what you're seeing. This is why it's brilliant. What actual deportation looks like is, hey, that's Bill. We have a warrant for his ass. Let's take Bill, and he's leaving. And if Bill happens to be in a house, and when we got the warrant to go get Bill, right? And they said that this is where Bill's living. And we get in there and there's other people in there and they happen to be illegal too. They might be going with Bill. You may not like that, but that's what's happening. They're not randomly going house. If they were going house to house randomly, right now you'd be able to go on TikTok or YouTube or wherever, Facebook Reels, Instagram, and you would see video after video after video after video after video after video after video of a bunch of thugs showing up at houses randomly knocking and saying, hey, let me see your papers. You've seen none of those because it's not happening. Yes, it is, but it's not. Show me it happening. Well, this one person got arrested and they were an American citizen. Did they? And then that turns into they're deporting American citizens. Did they get deported? Where are they now? Oh, they're back out in the street protesting. Why did they get wrapped up? Because they were shadowing these agents. When they went into operational mode and they were actually apprehending people, they inserted themselves. I'm like, okay, fine, you're going too. Well, I'm an American citizen. Well, we'll figure that out. And when they do, you either do or do not get charged for obstruction, but then you're cut loose as far as to the deportation charge. What I'm saying is you're not seeing deportation activity on your TV set, and the news is not even talking about it. And even the news agencies that you would say are on the side of the right, like Fox News, you're still showing you the same imagery. So your entire viewpoint of this is an activity that is not deportation in action. It is people trying to do the job of deportation, having to have their head count and their armament upped to deal with 2,000 people interfering with their attempt to go apprehend 100. That's what you're seeing, and it's by design. And the people that have designed these protests, and I showed you on Monday how they are trained. I showed you the old lady Karen in a church with a guy who's like her best friend holding her shoulders and her losing her fucking mind like she's being tortured while somebody else is being trained exactly how to film it from what angle. These are trained instigators and activists. Now, there's a whole bunch of them out there that are organically there. You have basically three classes of people at these protests. And probably the largest number, just in body count, are people that just showed up because everybody else did. And they believe in what they're doing. And they believe in what they're doing, and they're also ignorant of everything I'm telling you right now. They think they're helping, but they're not. Okay. Then you have the well-trained activists who are like the Karen I showed you in the video. And if you go back to Monday and you watch that video and you see where like I slowly move her back and forth, it looks so ridiculous. And you also like, I've seen her. Even though I haven't seen her, I've seen that person many times on my TV in the past few years. All the way back to like the BLM riots and all. I've seen this person act this way. And I've seen exactly what's, so they're being trained to do it. That is probably 10 to 15% of the people in the streets. And of those two groups, some portion of both of those groups are being paid to be there. And almost all of the trained activists are being paid to be there. You can say that's not true, but we do have evidence that that's happening. We have people admitting they're being paid to be there. We all know this is real, and the people that say it's not true that they're being paid, you know it too, you just don't want it to be true, so you deny it. You're being untrue to yourself when you do that. Stop doing that. And then we have the actual organizers. The people that fund it, the people that organize the organizers, all right? The people that organize the trainings that those people, other people get trained in, those people get nowhere near the road. They get nowhere near the street. They don't do any of the dirty work. They are the interim, because there's a fourth class is the people actually paying for it. The Soros Foundation, the Tide Foundation. There's these intermediaries, though, that are going, that are moving that money into that channel, because you don't end up with 1,000 perfectly printed signs to protest something 4 hours after it happens unless it was pre-gamed. So you know that funding's coming in. So that's the people organizing it and the people funding the organizers. They're the people that are really responsible for what you're seeing, and they're painting a picture for you to see. And everything you know, you think you know about what's happening has nothing to do with the actual operational mission of deport people. Okay. If you don't want people deported, I understand, I just disagree with you. But even if that's you, you still are not seeing deportations. The people you see being thrown into cars on your TV set are not illegal aliens. You're correct. They are American citizens. You're correct. They're not being deported. They're being apprehended and arrested for attacking, pushing, shoving, interfering with, using their vehicles to block federal agents engaged in their lawful activities. It is not unconstitutional. There could be far more arrests than there are right now. As I said on Monday, if I see you getting a speeding ticket from a motorcycle cop whose only job is to write tickets, that's all he does, and I don't like the way he's talking to you, if I stand over on the other side of the street and go, hey, asshole, leave him alone, I haven't broken the law. If I approach him and he tells me to stand back and I place myself between him and you and refuse to allow him back to you, I am getting arrested right there and I'm going to be prosecuted for obstruction of a law enforcement officer in the commission of his duties. That is all that it takes. You're just kissing ass and licking bush. Shut up. I'm telling you the law. I'm not telling you how the law should be. I'm telling you what the law is. And I'm telling you the people behind this know everything I'm saying is true. And so they know they are pushing the buttons to get the responses they want. And they're doing so with an understanding that if you do this enough, you're going to have things that escalate into violence. And at the point that they escalate into violence, what you want is people there to document the violence from your viewpoint, not the viewpoint. In other words, you know, we're just going to leave the part out where all the other shit happened. And now it just looks like here's a soccer mom who was just trying to turn her car around, being jerked out of her car and arrested for no reason at all, except that she's kind of brown, which is what happened yesterday. But if you look at the totality of what happened, this woman tried to box these agents in and crush them against another protester's vehicle that they were coordinating together and tried to basically crush officers between two vehicles. Yeah, you got arrested. And if, like I said already, if it's up to me, if I'm running this operation, I'm telling all my people, if they touch you, immediate arrest. If they get in the way of a vehicle in motion, immediate arrest. If they pull their vehicle sideways in the center of a road and block traffic and block your vehicles from proceeding along with other civilians' vehicles from proceeding, immediate arrest. If they do anything that we can charge them with obstruction with, then arrest them. And I'm doing that so less people will get shot. You just thought you did. No, I'm doing that because I don't want to see another woman shot in these situations that are being created by people that do not care if they get shot. Those who are kind when they should be cruel, leaving the border wide open for four fucking years. Thank you, potato salad head. Right? Then you will have to be cruel when you should be kind. It's ancient wisdom for a reason. It does not change. This is where we are in this now. And all of this special pleading, well, what about this person that they live here and they never commit any crime and they never defraud anybody? They're not in any welfare. They work really, really hard. Okay, fine. And you know what everybody felt about those people 10 years ago? We can do something there. Fix the border, which they refused to do. The reason that never got done is because they would not prevent people from getting into the country illegally. So anything you did for those people got done for everybody. And the average person with a sense of one thing we have that is bigger than rooting for the underdog in our society, and it can be used against us or for us, depending on us, is a sense of fairness. And the average person's sense of fairness went, no, that's not okay. You're telling me about these Dreamer kids and all that are like 40 now, by the way, 10 years ago, while they're still actively pouring in from all around. No, I'm not okay with that. So the people that are not causing any problems, never did cause any problems, never got sideways with the law, never defrauded the country, aren't on food stamps, work a job, take care of their kids, they're your next door neighbors, they work at anything from the car dealership to the taco stand, the average person doesn't, you're right, they don't have a problem with them. But they are going to get swept up in this too. Because you let it get like this. And as I said, you can either be for open borders or you can have a welfare state. And by the way, no matter what you do, if you import the third world, you turn into the third world. In many of your teeny tiny heads, you're still thinking about Mario who puts drywall in right now. That is not the people that are actually a problem here. And many of these people being arrested, that these people are marching in the streets to protect, have committed crimes like, oh, I don't know, murder, sodomy of a minor. Okay? And you're defending these people, even though you don't think you are, because they have created an illusion for you. When you turn on your TV next time and put a news channel on, and you see video of these protests, understand, you're not looking at immigration enforcement at all. Nothing about what you're seeing is immigration enforcement. It's immigration enforcement officials being forced to deal with protest crowd control. And one more thing on the whole protest thing. This is another illusion that they have created in your minds. Because the person's protesting, they can do these things that otherwise they wouldn't be able to do these things, said no legal scholar ever. Ever. If it's illegal when you're not protesting, it's still illegal when you're protesting. And Jack, you're supposed to be an anarchist, and you're not supposed to, none of this is relevant to reality. Do you understand that? None of it's relevant to reality. I am all for subversive action when it weakens the state's ability to do things to good, peaceful people. Did you notice the word I used, though? Subversive. In other words, not stupid. Not stupid. See, and but Jack, I thought you said this was brilliant. It's brilliant if you're a person with a few billion dollars up your asshole and you want to change society to what you want it to be so that you'll have more power and you're the one pulling the levers and yanking the strings. That's brilliant. If you are one of the people in the streets, you are a useful idiot. And that isn't smart. That isn't brilliant. That's dumb. And it's not going to get done what you think you want done. That's what makes you a useful idiot. You don't have any idea what you're contributing to. You don't have any idea the motivations of the people paying for you to act like a clown in a circus are. You don't know what you're being manipulated into doing. Now, I know that by siding with the people that are in power right now, taking these actions to deport people, that I'm making a deal with a devil. I am aware of that. You are not. That is a key critical difference. In other words, I'm only okay with what's going on because it's necessary. And that doesn't give them a pass for a whole bunch of other shit that you're coming up with they're going to do one day. And those are like, they're building a bigger, stronger government, and they're going to use it against us. Well, then, you know what? I would like a few tens of millions of less third worlders in my country when we have to have that fight. Okay? Again, the less I trust my government, the more I don't want illegal immigration and the more I want illegal immigrants deported. If I trust in my government to control violent uprisings, if I trust in my government not to give my fucking money to people that aren't even supposed to fucking be here, if I could trust it to do those two things alone, my entire viewpoint of this would shift some. But I don't trust them to do that, nor anything else. So people are like, but you're trusting them to deport people. Yes, because that's a binary process. Are you here illegally? Yes, goodbye. That is like a Walmart checkout girl level of intellect necessary to conduct that operation. I don't like the way they're doing it. What don't you like about it? The part you see on TV that's not deportation? The part where they drag soccer moms out of their cars because they're retarded idiot lesbians who try to run people over? I'm not even talking about the one who gets shot. There's plenty of other ones. What is it you don't like? What is unconstitutional? They're going around door to door. They're not. Show it to me. All these things people claim are being done, show it to me. Don't give me a list of things like, well, this one place, this one person got arrested and they... I don't care about that. Where is that person now? And what were they doing when they got arrested? Before we even talk about the fact that it exists. But this person who was arrested and deported, they lived here for 15 years. But what were they arrested for? Why were they sought out in the first place? Well, and if it does turn out, well, they didn't really do anything. Okay, so how did they come into contact with ICE in the first place? Well, ICE went there and they arrested Pedro. And they also got Tommy. Oh, okay. And Tommy's the good one? Yeah. What did Pedro do? Oh, well, he had a warrant for fraud and for touching children. Oh. How are they related? Well, they were living together. I'm sorry, Tommy. I'm sorry. I wish it had worked out better for you, bro. I really do. But you are a very minor, collateral damage in this operation. I'm sorry. You should have stayed away from Pedro. And if we didn't have sanctuary cities, none of this would be happening. It is the sanctuary cities that create this dynamic in the first place. Because here's what should happen. I arrest you, and I don't care if I'm a Democrat or a Republican, I arrest you for a very serious crime. Very serious. Robbery, murder, assault, aggravated battery, fraud, rape, sex assault on a minor, something like that. I arrest you for that. I put you in a cage. I process you and I book you. When I run your shit, it turns out you're in the country illegally. I have a way to get rid of you now. If the prosecutor's not going to prosecute you for all this shit and put you back on the street, which these blue cities are doing, I have a mechanism by which you can no longer do this to the people that I am sworn to protect. And I should be making a phone call. Hey, you're looking for, Billy Bob? Yeah, we have him right here, right now. He was just picked up. He committed another assault. I'm looking at his rap sheet. Turns out he's a He's a native of Guatemala, and he's in the country illegally. Come get him. That's what should happen. And if that was happening, all of this dynamic would not be where it is. And so you have to ask yourself, well, who's making that decision? The average cop is not making that decision. The average cop does not like, I mean, there's some idiot cops, right? But the average cop, right, because you guys all vilify the cop. They just want to throw you in jail and trick you and get rid of you and blah. Okay, well then if that's true, they probably want that person put in a fucking trebuchet and trebuchet out into the Pacific Ocean if not deported. So they don't want to do it. But, so who makes them? Police chiefs. How do police chiefs get to be police chiefs? Usually by, metaphorically anyway, sucking a lot of asshole. Okay? They are cheese-eating, as we used to call them in the military, cheese-eating, ass-kissing little political bitches who get themselves into these positions of power. And they generally do that through town councils, city councils, and mayors, who tend to be in these places left-wing lunatic Democrats. And they know exactly what they're doing with these policies. But if we turn people over to ICE, then the community won't work with us. Like, the community work with you with what? Pedophiles you let back on the street? You see how none of this makes any sense? There's no world in which any of this defense of this behavior makes sense unless you just want it to in your brain because, as I said on Monday, I have to side with the protesters because I hate the government. If you have to side with the protesters because you hate the government, you're no better than people that say, I have to side with the government because I hate the protesters. Every one of these situations should be judged individually. But I do think it's interesting. I keep hearing my special libertarian friends talk about, it's a shame to see all of the so-called warriors for liberty and freedom from the COVID days siding with the state now. Wait a minute. Who sided with the state then? The same people that are in the streets right now. Oh, and by the way, this is not an equivalency. This is a total false equivalency, right? Logical fallacy. You going out to swim on the beach and having cops arrest you for not wearing a mask is not the same as Billy Bob, who has a warrant out for multiple felonies, being pursued by ICE so that they can be apprehended and deported. Or even Billy Bob simply being detained and thrown out because he's here illegally, period. It's not the same. Oh, and by the way, who are all these people that are out in the street right now? They're the ones that said you were killing grandma, you need to wear a mask, stay 6 feet away. They're the same people that all went out into the streets, arm in arm, for months in the so-called summer of love. You want consistency, you get it from me. That was idiocy, and this is idiocy, and it's the same people being run by the same organizations to the same political end. The people right now that are trying to deport people in our country illegally, especially those with long rap sheets, are not the same people that tried to make you get the jab. Except for maybe Trump, who didn't try to make you get the jab, by the way. He was always opposed to mandatory injections. He still thinks it's a big, beautiful, wonderful vaccine, which I totally disagree with, and I think he's a fucking arrogant idiot for saying that. See how it works? I can both acknowledge what the guy did right and say what he did wrong in two consecutive sentences. It's not that hard to be a free, independent thinker. More of you should try it. With that, I'm going to wrap up for the weekend. I hope you enjoyed my ending rant there. I'm sure it pissed off more of you. I'm sorry. Facts can do that. Have a great weekend, and I'll catch you again Monday. And I'm going to tell you right out of the gate, Monday we're not talking about any of this political bullshit. I am done for at least a couple weeks. And next week will be a bit of a short week. Monday and Tuesday will be normal. And then I'm off to Viva Las Vegas. Why? SHOT Show. Sort of, kind of, not really. My wife wanted to go see the Eagles play in the Sphere. So we're going to do that. Take care, guys. I'll catch you on Monday. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.